Secret Agent Hero, how are you doing? Hero turns around. Juanita is right behind him, standing out in her black and white avatar, looking good anyway. How are you? She asks.
Fine, how are you?
Great. I hope you don't mind talking to me in this ugly facts of life avatar.
Juanita, I would rather look at a fax of you than most other women in the flesh.
Thanks, you sly bastard. It's been a long time since we've talked, she observes, as though there's something remarkable about this. Something's going on. I hope you're not going to mess around with Snow Crash, she says. David won't listen to me.
What am I, a model of self-restraint? I'm exactly the kind of guy who would mess around with it.
I know you better than that. You're impulsive, but you're very clever. You have those sword-fighting reflexes.
What does that have to do with drug abuse?
It means you can see bad things coming and deflect them. It's an instinct, not a learned thing. As soon as you turned around and saw me, that look came over your face, like, what's going on? What the hell is Juanita up to?
I didn't think you talked to people in the metaverse.
I do if I want to get through to someone in a hurry, she says. And I'll always talk to you.
Why me?
You know, because of us. Remember, because of our relationship, when I was writing this thing? You and I are the only two people who can ever have an honest conversation in the metaverse.
You're just the same mystical crank you always were, he says, smiling so as to make this a charming statement.
You can't imagine how mystical and cranky I am now, Hero.
How mystical and cranky are you?
She eyes him warily. Exactly the same way she did when he came into her office years ago. It comes into his mind to wonder why she is always so alert in his presence. In college, he used to think that she was afraid of his intellect, but he's known for years that this is the last of her worries. At Black Sun Systems, he figured that it was just typical female guardedness. Juanita was afraid he was trying to get her into the sack. But this, too, is pretty much out of the question. At this late date in his romantic career, he's just canny enough to come up with a new theory. She's being careful because she likes him. She likes him in spite of herself. He's exactly the kind of tempting but utterly wrong romantic choice that a smart girl like Juanita must learn to avoid. That's definitely it. There's something to be said for getting older. By way of answering his question, she says, I have an associate I'd like you to meet. A gentleman and a scholar named Lagos. He's a fascinating guy to talk to.
Is he your boyfriend?
She thinks this one over rather than lashing out instantaneously. My behavior at the Black Sun, to the contrary, I don't fuck every male I work with. And even if I did, Lagos is out of the question.
Not your type?
Not by a long shot.
What is your type, anyway?
Old, rich, unimaginative blondes with steady careers. This one almost slips by him. Then he catches it.
Well, I could dye my hair, and I'll get old eventually.
She actually laughs. It's a tension-releasing kind of outburst. Believe me, Hero, I'm the last person you want to be involved with at this point.
Is this part of your church thing? He asks.
Juanita has been using her excess money to start her own branch of the Catholic Church. She considers herself a missionary to the intelligent atheists of the world. Don't be condescending, she says. That's exactly the attitude I'm fighting. Religion is not for simpletons.
Sorry. This is unfair, you know. You can read every expression on my face, and I'm looking at you through a fucking blizzard.
It's definitely related to religion, she says. But this is so complex, and your background in that area is so deficient, I don't know where to begin.
Hey, I went to church every week in high school. I sang in the choir.
I know. That's exactly the problem. 99% of everything that goes on in most Christian churches has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual religion. Intelligent people all notice this sooner or later, and they conclude that the entire 100% is bullshit, which is why atheism is connected with being intelligent in people's minds.
So, none of that stuff I learned in church has anything to do with what you're talking about?
Juanita thinks for a while, eyeing him. Then she pulls a hypercard out of her pocket. Here, Take this. As Hero pulls it from her hand, the hypercard changes from a jittery two-dimensional figment into a realistic cream-colored, finely textured piece of stationery. Printed across its face in glossy black ink is a pair of words. The first word, B-A-B-E-L, Babel. The second word, Infocalypse. Nine. The world freezes and grows dim for a second. The black sun loses its smooth animation and begins to move in fuzzy stop action. Clearly, his computer has just taken a major hit. All of its circuits are busy processing a huge bolus of data, the contents of the hypercard, and don't have time to redraw the image of the black sun in its full, breathtaking fidelity. Holy shit, he says, when the black sun pops back into full animation again. What the hell is in this card? You must have half the library in here. And a librarian to boot, Juanita says, to help you sort through it. And lots of videotapes of L. Bob Reif, which accounts for most of the bytes. Well, I'll try to have a look at it, he says dubiously. Do. Unlike David, you're just smart enough to benefit from this. And in the meantime, stay away from Raven. And stay away from Snow Crash, okay? Who's Raven? He asks. But Juanita is already on her way out the door. The fancy avatars all turn around to watch her as she goes past them. The movie stars give her drop-dead looks, and the hackers purse their lips and stare reverently. Hero orbits back around to the hacker quadrant. David's shuffling hypercards around on his table. Business stats in the black sun, film and video clips, hunks of software, scrawled telephone numbers. There's a little blip in the operating system that hits me right in the gut every time you come in the door, David says. I always have this premonition that the black sun is headed for a crash.
Must be big board, Hero says. It has one routine that patches some of the traps in low memory for a moment.
Ah, that's it. Please, please, throw that thing away, David says.
What, big board?
Yeah, it was totally rad at one point, but now it's like trying to work on a fusion reactor with a stone axe.
Thanks.
I'll give you all the headers you need if you want to update it to something a little less dangerous, David says. I wasn't impugning your abilities. I'm just saying you need to keep up with the times.
It's fucking hard, Hero says. There's no place for a freelance hacker anymore. You have to have a big corporation behind you.
I'm aware of that, and I'm aware that you can't stand to work for a big corporation. That's why I'm saying I'll give you the stuff you need. You're always a part of the Black Sun to me, Hero, even since we parted ways.
It is classic David. He's talking with his heart again, bypassing his head. If David weren't a hacker, Hero would despair of his ever having enough brains to do anything.
Let's talk about something else, Hero says. Was I just hallucinating, or are you and Juanita on speaking terms again?
David gives him an indulgent smile. He has been very kind to Hero ever since the conversation several years back. It was a conversation that started out as a friendly chat over beer and oysters between a couple of longtime comrades in arms. It was not until three-quarters of the way through the conversation that it dawned on Hero that he was, in fact, being fired at this very moment. Since the conversation, David has been known to feed Hero useful bits of intel and gossip from time to time.
Fishing for something useful? David asks knowingly.
Like many bitheads, David is utterly guileless, but at times like this, he thinks he's the reincarnation of Machiavelli.
I got news for you, man, Hero says. Most of the stuff you give me, I never put into the library.
Why not? Hell, I give you all my best gossip. I thought you were making money off that stuff.
I just can't stand it, Hero says, taking parts of my private conversations and whoring them out. Why do you think I'm broke?
There's another thing he doesn't mention, which is that he's always considered himself to be David's equal, and he can't stand the idea of feeding off David's little crumbs and tidbits like a dog curled up under his table.
I was glad to see Juanita come in here, even as a black and white, David says. For her not to use the black sun. It's like Alexander Graham Bell refusing to use the telephone. Why did she come in tonight? Something's bugging her, David says. She wanted to know if I'd seen certain people on the street. Anyone in particular? She's worried about a really large guy with long black hair, David says, peddling something called, get this, Snow Crash. Has she tried the library? Yeah, I assume so, anyway. Have you seen this guy? Oh, yeah. It's not hard to find him, David says. He's right outside the door. I got this from him. David scans the table, picks up one of the hyper cards, and shows it to Hero. Snow Crash. Tear this card in half to release your free sample. David, Hero says, I can't believe you took a hyper card from a black and white person. David laughs. This is not the old days, my friend. I've got so much antiviral medicine in my system that nothing can get through. I get so much contaminated shit from all the hackers who come through here. It's like working in a plague ward. So I'm not afraid of whatever's in this hyper card.
Well, in that case, I'm curious, Hero says.
Yeah, me too, David laughs.
It's probably something very disappointing.
Probably an animercial, David agrees. Think I should do it?
Yeah, go for it. It's not every day you get to try out a new drug, Hero says.
Well, you can try one every day if you want to, David says. But it's not every day you find one that can't hurt you.
He picks up the hypercard and tears it in half. For a second, nothing happens.
I'm waiting, David says.
An avatar materializes on the table in front of David, starting out ghostly and transparent, gradually becoming solid and three-dimensional. It's a really trite effect. Hero and David are already laughing. The avatar is a stark naked Brandy. It doesn't even look like the standard Brandy. This looks like one of the cheap Taiwanese Brandy knockoffs. Clearly, it's just a demon. She's holding a pair of tubes in her hands about the size of paper towel rolls. David is leaning back in his chair, enjoying this. There's something hilariously tawdry about the entire scene. The Brandy leans forward, beckoning David toward her. David leans into her face, grinning broadly. She puts her crude, ruby-red lips up by his ear and mumbles something that Hero can't hear. When she leans back away from David, his face has changed. He looks dazed and expressionless. Maybe David really looks that way. Maybe Snow Crash has messed up his avatar somehow so that it's no longer tracking David's true facial expressions. But he's staring straight ahead, eyes frozen in their sockets. The Brandy holds the pair of tubes up in front of David's immobilized face and spreads them apart. It's actually a scroll. She's unrolling it right in front of David's face, spreading it apart like a flat two-dimensional screen in front of his eyes. David's paralyzed face has taken on a bluish tinge as it reflects light coming out of the scroll. Hero walks around the table to look. He gets a brief glimpse of the scroll before the Brandy snaps it shut again. It is a living wall of light, like a flexible, flat-screened television set, and it's not showing anything at all. Just static. White noise. Snow. Then she's gone, leaving no trace behind. Desultory sarcastic applause sounds from a few tables in the hacker quadrant. David's back to normal, wearing a grin that's part snide and part embarrassed.
What was it? Hero says. I just glimpsed some snow at the very end.
You saw the whole thing, David says. A fixed pattern of black and white pixels, fairly high resolution. Just a few hundred thousand ones and zeros for me to look at.
So in other words, someone just exposed your optic nerve to what? Maybe 100,000 bytes of information, Hero says.
Noise is more like it.
Well, all information looks like noise until you break the code, Hero says.
Why would anyone show me information in binary code? I'm not a computer. I can't read a bitmap.
Relax, David. I'm just shitting you, Hero says.
You know what it was? You know how hackers are always trying to show me samples of their work?
Yeah.
Some hacker came up with a scheme to show me his stuff. And everything worked fine until the moment the Brandy opened the scroll. But his code was
buggy, and it snow crashed at the wrong moment, so instead of seeing his output, all I saw was snow.
Then why did he call the thing snow crash?
Gallows humor. He knew it was buggy.
What did the brandy whisper in your ear?
Some language I didn't recognize, David says. Just a bunch of babble.
Babble. Babble. Afterward, you look sort of stunned. David looks resentful.
I wasn't stunned. I just found the whole experience so weird. I guess I just was taken aback for a second.
Hero is giving him an extremely dubious look. David notices it and stands up.
Want to go see what your competitors in Nippon are up to?
What competitors?
You used to design avatars for rock stars, right?
Still do.
Well, Sushi K is here tonight.
Oh, yeah. The hairdo the size of a galaxy.
You can see the rays from here, David says, waving toward the next quadrant. But I want to see the whole getup.
It does look as though the sun is rising somewhere in the middle of the Rockstar quadrant. Above the heads of the milling avatars, Hero can see a fan of orange beams radiating outward from some point in the middle of the crowd. It keeps moving, turning around, shaking from side to side, and the whole universe seems to move with it. On the street, the full radiance of Sushi K's rising sun hairdo is suppressed by the height and width regulations, but David allows free expression inside the black sun, so the orange rays extend all the way to the property lines.
I wonder if anyone's told him yet that the Americans won't buy rap music from a Japanese person, Hero says as they stroll over there.
Maybe you should tell him, David suggests. Charge him for the service. He's in L.A. right now, you know.
Probably staying in a hotel full of bootlickers telling him what a big star he's going to be. He needs to be exposed to some actual biomass.
They inject themselves into a stream of traffic, winding a narrow channel through a rift in the crowd.
Biomass, David says.
A body of living stuff. It's an ecology term. If you take an acre of rainforest or a cubic mile of ocean or a square block of Compton and strain out all the non-living stuff, dirt and water, you get the biomass.
David, ever the bithead, says,
I do not understand.
His voice sounds funny. There's a lot of white noise creeping into his audio.
Industry expression, Hero says. The industry feeds off the human biomass of America, like a whale straining krill from the sea.
Hero wedges himself between a couple of Nippanese businessmen. One is wearing uniform blue, but the other is a neo-traditional, wearing a dark kimono. And like Hero, he's wearing two swords, the long katana on his left hip and the one-handed wakizashi stuck diagonally in his waistband. He and Hero glance cursorily at each other's armaments. Then Hero looks away and pretends not to notice, while the neo-traditional is freezing solid except for the corners of his mouth, which are curling downward. Hero has seen this kind of thing before. He knows he's about to get into a fight. People are moving out of the way. Something big and inexorable is plunging through the crowd, shoving avatars this way and that. Only one thing has the ability to shove people around like that inside the black sun, and that's a bouncer demon. As they get closer, Hero sees that it's a whole flying wedge of them, gorillas in tuxedos, real gorillas, and they seem to be headed toward Hero. He tries to back away, but he quickly runs into something. Looks like Big Board finally got him in trouble. He's on his way out of the bar.
David, Hero says, call them off, man. I'll stop using it.
All of the people in his vicinity are staring over Hero's shoulder, their faces illuminated by a stew of brilliant colored lights. Hero turns around to look at David, but David's not there anymore. Instead of David, there's just a jittering cloud of bad digital karma. It's so bright and fast and meaningless that it hurts to look at. It flashes back and forth from color to black and white, and when it's in color, it rolls wildly around the color wheel as though being strafed with high-powered disco lights. And it's not staying within its own body space. Hair-thin pixel lines keep shooting off to one side, passing all the way across the black sun and out through the wall. It is not so much an organized body as it is a centrifugal cloud of lines and polygons whose center cannot hold,
throwing bright bits of body shrapnel all over the room, interfering with people's avatars, flickering and disappearing. The gorillas don't mind. They shove their long, furry fingers into the midst of the disintegrating cloud and latch onto it somehow and carry it past Hero toward the exit. Hero looks down as it goes past him and sees what looks very much like David's face as viewed through a pile of shattered glass. It's just a momentary glimpse. Then the avatar is gone, expertly drop-kicked out the front door, soaring out over the street in a long, flat arc that takes it over the horizon. Hero looks up the aisle to see David's table, empty, surrounded by stunned hackers. Some of them are shocked. Some are trying to stifle grins. David Meyer, Supreme Hacker Overlord, founding father of the Metaverse Protocol, creator and proprietor of the world-famous Black Sun, has just suffered a system crash. He's been thrown out of his own bar by his own demons. About the second or third thing they learned how to do when studying to become couriers was how to shiv open a pair of handcuffs. Handcuffs are not intended as long-term restraint devices. Millions of Clink franchisees are the contrary. And the long-time status of skateboarders as an oppressed ethnic group means that, by now, all of them are escape artists of some degree. First things first, YT has many a thing hanging off her uniform. The uniform has 100 pockets, big flat pockets for deliveries, and eensy narrow pockets for gear, pockets sewn into sleeves, thighs, shins. The equipment stuck into these multifarious pockets tends to be small, tricky, lightweight. Pens, markers, pen lights, pen knives, lockpicks, barcode scanners, flares, screwdrivers, liquid knuckles, Bundy stunners, and light sticks. A calculator stuck upside down to her right thigh, doubling as a taxi meter and a stopwatch. On the other thigh is a personal phone. As the manager is locking the door upstairs, it begins to ring. YT off-hooks it with her free hand. It's her mother.
Hi, Mom. Fine, how are you? I'm at Tracy's house. Yeah, we went to the Metaverse. We were just fooling around at this arcade on the street. Pretty bumpin'. Yes, I used the nice avatar. Nah, Tracy's mom said she'd give me a ride home later. But we might stop off at the Joyride on Victory for a while, okay? Okay, well, sleep tight, Mom. I will. I love you too. See you later.
She punches the flash button, killing the chat with Mom and giving her a fresh dial tone in the space of about half a second.
Roadkill, she says.
The telephone remembers and dials Roadkill's number. Roaring sounds. This is the sound of air peeling over the microphone of Roadkill's personal phone at some terrifying velocity. Also the competing whooshes of many vehicles' tires on pavement, broken by chuckhole percussion, sounds like the crumbling Ventura.
Yo, YT, Roadkill says. Sup? Sup with you?
Surfing the Tura. Sup with you?
Maxing the Clink.
Whoa, who popped you?
Metacops. Affixed me to the gate of White Columns with a loogie gun.
Whoa, how very. When you leaving?
Soon. Can you swing by and give me a hand?
What do you mean?
Men. You know, give me a hand. You're my boyfriend, she says, speaking very simply and plainly. If I get popped, you're supposed to come around and help bust me out.
Isn't everyone supposed to know this stuff? Don't parents teach their kids anything anymore?
Well, where are you?
Buy and fly number 501,762.
I'm on my way to Bernie with a super ultra.
As in San Bernardino. As in super ultra high priority delivery. As in, you're out of luck.
Okay, thanks for nothing.
Sorry.
Surfing safety,
YT says in the traditional sarcastic sign-off.
Keep breathing,
Roadkill says. The roaring noise snaps off. What a jerk. Next date, he's really going to have to grovel. But in the meantime, there's one other person who owes her one. The only problem is that he might be a spaz, but it's worth a try.
Hello?
He says into his personal phone. He's breathing hard, and a couple of sirens are dueling in the background.
Hero protagonist?
Yeah. Who's this?
YT, where are you?
In the parking lot of a Safeway on Oahu, he says.
And he's telling the truth. In the background, she can hear the shopping carts performing their clashy anal copulations.
I'm kind of busy now, Whitey. But what can I do for you?
It's YT, she says. And you can help bust me out of the clink.
She gives him the details.
How long ago did he put you there?
10 minutes.
Okay. The three-ring binder for clink franchises states that the manager is supposed to check on the detainee half an hour after admission.
How do you know this stuff? She says accusingly.
Use your imagination. As soon as the manager pulls his half-hour check, wait for another 5 minutes and then make your move. I'll try to give you a hand, okay?
Got it.
At half an hour on the dot, she hears the back door being unlocked. The lights come on. Her night vision saves her from racking eyeball pains. The manager thunks down a couple of steps, glares at her for rather a long time. The manager clearly is tempted. That momentary glimpse of flesh has been ricocheting around in his brain for half an hour. He is racking his mind with vast cosmological dilemmas. YT hopes that he does not try anything because the dentata's effects can be unpredictable.
Make up your fucking mind, she says.
It works. This fresh burst of culture shock rattles the jeek out of his ethical conundrum. He gives YT a disapproving glower. She, after all, forced him to be attracted to her, forced him to get horny, made his head swim. She didn't have to get arrested, did she? And so on top of everything else, he's angry with her, as if he has a right to be. This is the gender that invented the polio vaccine? He turns, goes back up the steps, kills the light, locks the door. She notes the time, sets her alarm watch for 5 minutes from now. The only North American who actually knows how to set the alarm on her digital wristwatch. Pulls her shiv kit from one of the narrow pockets on her sleeve. She also hauls out a light stick and snaps it so she can see what's up. She finds one piece of narrow, flat spring steel, slides it up into the manacle's innards, depresses the spring-loaded pawl. The cuff, formerly a one-way ratchet that could only get tighter, springs loose from the cold water pipe. She could take it off her wrist, but she has decided she likes the look of it. She cuffs the loose manacle onto her wrist, right next to the other one, forming a double bracelet. The kind of thing her mom used to do, back when she was a punk. The steel door is locked, but by-and-fly safety regs mandate an emergency exit from the basement in case of fire. Here, it's a basement window with Mondo bars and a big red multilingual fire alarm bolted onto it. The red looks black in the green glow of the light stick. She reads the instructions that are in English, runs through it once or twice in her mind, then waits for the alarm to go off. She whiles away the time by reading the instructions in all the other languages, wondering which is which. It all looks like taxi lingo to YT. The window is almost too grungy to see through, but she sees something black walking past it. Hero. About 10 seconds later, her wristwatch goes off. She punches the emergency exit. The bell rings. The bars are trickier than she thought. Good thing it's not a real fire, but eventually she gets them open. She throws her plank outside onto the parking lot, drags her body through just as she hears the rear door being unlocked. By the time the three-ringer has found that all-important light switch, she is banking a sharp turn into the front lot, which has turned into a Jeek festival. Every Jeek in Southern Cal is here, it seems, driving their giant wrecked taxicabs with alien livestock in the backseat, reeking of incense and sloshing neon-hued air wicks. They have set up a giant eight-tubed hookah on the trunk of one of the cabs and are slurping up great mountain man lungfuls of choking smoke. And they're all staring at hero protagonist, who is just staring back at them. Everyone in the parking lot looks completely astounded. He must have made his approach from the rear, didn't realize that the front lot was full of Jeeks. Whatever he was planning isn't going to work.
The plan is screwed. The manager comes running around from the back of the Bionfly, sounding a blood-curdling taxilinga toxin. He's got missile lock on YT's ass. But the jeeks around the hookah don't care about YT. They've got missile lock on Hero. They carefully hang the ornate silver nozzles on a rack built into the neck of the megabong. Then they start moving toward him, reaching into the folds of their robes, the inner pockets of their windbreakers. YT is distracted by a sharp hissing noise. Her eyes glance back at Hero, and she sees that he has withdrawn a 3-foot curved sword from a scabbard, which she did not notice before. He has dropped into a squat. The blade of the sword glitters painfully under the killer security lights of the Bionfly. How sweet! It would be an understatement to say that the hookah boys are taken aback, but they're not scared so much as they are confused. Almost undoubtedly, most of them have guns. So why is this guy trying to bother them with a sword? She remembers that one of the multiple professions on Hero's business card is greatest sword fighter in the world. Can he really take out a whole clan of armed jeeks? The manager's hand clenches her upper arm, like this is really going to stop her. She reaches across her body with the other hand and lets him have it with a brief squirt of liquid knuckles. He makes a muffled, distant grunt. His head snaps back. He lets go of her arm and staggers back wildly until he sprawls against another taxi, jamming the heels of both hands into his eye sockets. Wait a sec. There's nobody in that particular taxi, but she can see a 2-foot-long macrame keychain dangling from the ignition. She tosses her plank through the window of the taxi, dives in after it. She's small, opening the door is optional. Climbs in behind the driver's seat, sinking into a deep nest of wooden beads and air fresheners, grinds the motor and takes off. Backward. Headed for the rear parking lot. The car was pointed outward in taxicab style, ready for a quick getaway, which would be fine if she were by herself. But there is Hero to think of. The radio is screaming, alive with hollered bursts of taxi lingo. She backs all the way around behind the Bionfly. The back lot is strangely quiet and empty. She shifts into drive and blasts back the way she came. The jeeks haven't quite had time to react, or expecting her to come out the other way. She screams it to a halt right next to Hero, who has already had the presence of mind to put his sword back in its scabbard. He dives in the passenger side window. Then she stops paying attention to him. She's got other stuff to look at, such as whether she's going to get broadsided as she pulls out onto the road. She doesn't get broadsided, though a car has to squeal around her. She guns it out onto the highway. It responds as only an ancient taxicab will. The only problem being that half a dozen other ancient taxicabs are now following them. Something is pressing against YT's left thigh. She looks down. It is a remarkably huge revolver in a net bag hanging on the door panel. She has to find some place to pull into. If she could find a Nova Sicilia franchulet, that would do it. The Mafia owes her one. Or a New South Africa, which she hates. But the New South Africans hate jeeks even more. Scratch that. Hero is black, or at least part black. Can't take him into New South Africa. And because YT is a cock, they can't go to Medizania. Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, Hero says. 1/2 mile ahead on the right. Nice thinking. But they won't let you in with your swords, will they? Yes, he says. Because I'm a citizen. Then she sees it. The sign stands out because it is a rare one. Don't see many of these. It is a green and blue sign, soothing and calm in a glare-torn franchise ghetto. It says, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Explosive noise from in back. Her head smacks into the whiplash arrester. Another taxi rear-ended them. And she screams into the parking lot of Mr. Lee's doing 75. The security system doesn't even have time to res her visa and drop the STD. So it's severe tire damage all the way. Those bald radials are left behind on the spikes. Sparking along on 4 naked rims, she shrieks to a stop on the lawn grid, which doubles as carbon dioxide-eating turf, an impervious parking lot. She and Hero climb out of the car. Hero is grinning wildly,
pinioned in the crossfire of a dozen red laser beams scanning him from every direction at once. The Hong Kong robot security system is checking him out. Her too. She looks down to see the lasers scribbling across her chest.
"Welcome to Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, Mr. Protagonist," the security system says through a PA speaker. "And welcome to your guest, Ms. Whitey."
The other taxis have stopped in formation along the curb. Several of them overshot the Hong Kong franchise and had to back up a block or so, a barrage of doors thunking shut. Some of them don't bother, just leave the engines running and the doors wide open. Three jeeps linger on the sidewalk, eyeing the tire shreds impaled on spikes, long streaks of neoprene sprouting steel and fiberglass hairs like ruined toupees. One of them has a revolver in his hand, pointed straight down at the sidewalk. Four more jeeps run up to join them. YT counts two more revolvers and a pump shotgun. Any more of these guys and they'll be able to form a government. They step carefully over the spikes and onto the lush Hong Kong long grid. As they do, the lasers appear once more. The jeeps turn all red and grainy for a second. Then something different happens. Lights come on. The security system wants better illumination on these people. Hong Kong franchulets are famous for their lawn grids, whoever heard of a lawn you could park on, and for their antennas. They all look like NASA research facilities with their antennas. Some of them are satellite uplinks pointed at the sky, but some of them, tiny little antennas, are pointed at the ground, at the lawn grid. YT does not really get this, but these small antennas are millimeter wave radar transceivers. Like any other radar, they are good at picking up metallic objects. Unlike the radar in an air traffic control center, they can res fine details. The res of a system is only as fine as its wavelength. Since the wavelength of this radar is about a millimeter, it can see the fillings in your teeth, the grommets in your Converse high tops, the rivets in your Levi's. It can calculate the value of your pocket change. Seeing guns is not a problem. This thing can even tell if the guns are loaded and with what sort of ammunition. That is an important function, because guns are illegal in Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
Yes. 11. It doesn't seem polite to hang around and gawk over the fact that David's computer crashed. A lot of the younger hackers are doing just that, as a way of showing all the other hackers how knowledgeable they are. Hero shrugs it off and turns back in the direction of the Rockstar Quadrant. He still wants to see Sushi K's hairdo. But his path is being blocked by the Nipponese man, the neo-traditional, the guy with the swords. He's facing off against Hero about two sword lengths apart, and it doesn't look like he intends to move. Hero does the polite thing. He bows at the waist, straightens up. The businessman does the much less polite thing. He looks Hero rather carefully up and down, then returns the bow, sort of. "These," the businessman says. "Very nice."
"Thank you, sir. Please feel free to converse in Nipponese if you prefer."
"This is what your avatar wears. You do not carry such weapons in reality," the businessman says, in English.
"I'm sorry to be difficult, but in fact I do carry such weapons in reality," Hero says.
"Exactly like these?"
"Exactly."
"These are ancient weapons, then," the businessman says.
"Yes, I believe they are."
"How did you come to be in possession of such important family heirlooms from Nippon?" the businessman says.
Hero knows the subtext here. "What do you use those swords for, boy? Slicing watermelon?" "They are now my family heirlooms," Hero says. "My father won them."
"Won them? Gambling?"
"Single combat. It was a struggle between my father and a Nipponese officer. The story is quite complicated."
"Please excuse me if I have misinterpreted your story," the businessman says. "But I was under the impression that men of your race were not allowed to fight during that war."
"Your impression is correct," Hero says. "My father was a truck driver."
"Then how did he come to be in hand-to-hand combat with a Nipponese officer?"
"The incident took place outside a prisoner of war camp," Hero says. My father and another prisoner tried to escape. They were pursued by a number of Nipponese soldiers and the officer who owned these swords.
Your story is very difficult to believe, the businessman says, because your father could not have survived such an escape long enough to pass the swords on to his son. Nippon is an island nation. That is nowhere he could have escaped to.
This happened very late in the war, Hiro says, and this camp was just outside of Nagasaki. The businessman chokes, reddens, nearly loses it. His left hand reaches up to grip the scabbard of his sword. Hiro looks around. Suddenly, they are in the center of an open circle of people some 10 yards across.
Do you think that the manner in which you came to possess these swords was honorable? The businessman says.
If I did not, I would long since have returned them, Hiro says.
Then you will not object to losing them in the same fashion, the businessman says.
Nor will you object to losing yours, Hiro says. The businessman reaches across his body with his right hand, grips the handle of his sword just below the guard, draws it out, snaps it forward so it's pointing at Hiro, then places his left hand on the grip just below the right. Hiro does the same. Both of them bend their knees, dropping into a low squat while keeping the torso bolt upright, then stand up again and shuffle their feet into the proper stance. Feet parallel, both pointed straight ahead, right foot in front of the left foot. The businessman turns out to have a lot of zanshin. Translating this concept into English is like translating fuckface into Nipponese, but it might translate into emotional intensity in football lingo. He charges directly at Hiro, hollering at the top of his lungs. The movement actually consists of a very rapid shuffling motion of the feet, so that he stays balanced at all times. At the last moment, he draws the sword up over his head and snaps it down toward Hiro. Hiro brings his own sword up, rotating it around sideways, so that the handle is up high above and to the left of his face, and the blade slopes down and to the right, providing a roof above him. The businessman's blow bounces off this roof like rain, and then Hiro sidesteps to let him go by and snaps the sword down toward his unprotected shoulder. But the businessman is moving too fast, and Hiro's timing is off. The blade cuts behind and to the side of the businessman. Both men wheel to face each other, back up, get back into the stance. Emotional intensity doesn't convey the half of it, of course. It is the kind of coarse and disappointing translation that makes the dismembered bodies of samurai warriors spin in their graves. The word zanshin is larded down with a lot of other falderall that you have to be Nipponese to understand. And Hiro thinks, frankly, that most of it is pseudo-mystical crap, on the same level as his old high school football coach exhorting his men to play at 110%. The businessman makes another attack. This one is pretty straightforward. A quick shuffling approach, and then a snapping cut in the direction of Hiro's ribcage. Hiro parries it. Now, Hiro knows something about this businessman, namely, that like most Nipponese sword fighters, all he knows is kendo. Kendo is to real samurai sword fighting what fencing is to real swashbuckling. An attempt to take a highly disorganized, chaotic, violent, and brutal conflict and turn it into a cute game. As in fencing, you're only supposed to attack certain parts of the body, the parts that are protected by armor. As in fencing, you're not allowed to kick your opponent in the kneecaps or break a chair over his head. And the judging is totally subjective. In kendo, you can get a good, solid hit on your opponent and still not get credit for it, because the judges feel you didn't possess the right amount of zanshin. Hiro doesn't have any zanshin at all. He just wants this over with. The next time the businessman sets up his ear-splitting screech and shuffles toward Hiro, cutting and snapping his blade, Hiro parries the attack, turns around, and cuts both of his legs off just above the knees. The businessman collapses to the floor. It takes a lot of practice to make your avatar move through the metaverse like a real person. When your avatar has just lost its legs, all that skill goes out the window.
Well, land sakes, Hiro says. Looky here.
He whips his blade sideways, cutting off both of the businessman's forearms, causing the sword to clatter onto the floor.
Better fire up the old barbecue, Jemima.
Hero continues, whipping the sword around sideways, cutting the businessman's body in half just above the navel. Then he leans down so he's looking right into the businessman's face.
"Didn't anyone tell you," he says, losing the dialect, "that I was a hacker?"
Then he hacks the guy's head off. It falls to the floor, does a half roll, and comes to rest staring straight up at the ceiling. So Hero steps back a couple of paces and mumbles, "Safe." A largish safe, about a meter on a side, materializes just below the ceiling, plummets, and lands directly on the businessman's head. The impact drives both the safe and the head straight down through the floor of the Black Sun, leaving a square hole in the floor, exposing the tunnel system underneath. The rest of the dismembered body is still strewn around the floor. At this moment, a Nipponese businessman somewhere in a nice hotel in London or an office in Tokyo, or even in the first-class lounge of the LATH, the Los Angeles-Tokyo Hypersonic, is sitting in front of his computer, red-faced and sweating, looking at the Black Sun Hall of Fame. He has been cut off from contact with the Black Sun itself, disconnected, as it were, from the metaverse, and is just seeing a two-dimensional display. The top 10 swordsmen of all time are shown along with their photographs. Beneath is a scrolling list of numbers and names, starting with number 11. He can scroll down the list if he wants to find his own ranking. The screen helpfully informs him that he is currently ranked number 863 out of 890 people who have ever participated in a sword fight in the Black Sun. Number 1, the name and the photograph on the top of the list, belongs to Hideaki Protagonist.